This is the time. This is the place. Here and now, the mystery awaits to break into our experience, to change our minds, to change our lives, to help us see the world and the whole of life in a new light. This is the place. This is the time. Here and now, let us praise the mystery by joining together in song. And now, at the center of our service, at the center of our lives, we take this time to light candles of memory, candles of hope, candles of renewal, or because we feel troubled, blessed, conflicted, or simply because we'd like to add a little light to the world. Please join me in an attitude of prayer. Mystery of many names and mystery beyond all naming. Today we meet very close to this nation's birthday, the day in which this country declared itself independent of the British Empire. We would hope that that independence has done more than simply cut us off from the rest of the world. We would pray that in our good fortune and experience of the democratic process, that we would not forget that those things we fled from in the old world may, in fact, come back to haunt us. As a republic, we need to remember that although our sovereign power resides in those whom we elect, those so elected need to be responsible ultimately to we, the people. In these trying times when it seems that our nation is making more enemies than friends, in these times when elected representation ignores the best interests of those who elected them, give us the patience to withstand the affront and the willingness to get back the power that exists in the people themselves. Democracy is a prime example of relationship in action. Let us never forget that how we treat one another in this country is as equally important as how our country treats other countries. Fairness and peace are things that we must practice in our grassroots relationships. If peace is to be practiced in and by this country, it first must be practiced here in and by this covenant community. If love, empathy, and compassion are to be taught by freedom-loving people, then that love, empathy, and compassion must be a part of the cloth that goes to make up this coveting community. May we recognize the fact that the entire world is as interdependent, is an interdependent whole. Help us, Great Spirit, to humbly remember our births, to graciously remember that we shall all die, and to treat our mother, the earth, as the living being she is. We ask this in the name of everything that is holy, and that is precisely everything. Amen. A sun is a nuclear engine. It started up a long, long time ago, 4.5 billion years ago, to be exact. It's been revving up its engine ever since. Scientists estimate that in 500 million years from now, that's in half a billion years, our sun, we call it ours, you know, our sense of property has no bounds, our sun will heat up to the point that the surface of our beloved planet Earth will be about the same temperature as Venus, around 750 degrees Fahrenheit, with a 10 degrees variance all over the planet. In other words, there won't be a planet Earth, not as we know it. There is speculation in scientific circles that the future of the human race, Homo sapiens, rests on the technology that will take us to Mars, the next planet that will be ready for life as we know it. There have been a lot of science fiction movies made where Earth is threatened from forces outside our galaxy. Looks like we've been looking too far away. It seems something closer to home will eventually be our undoing. Speaking of galaxies, do you remember this ditty when you were in grade school? Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is rolling down the alley in a blue and yellow Ford. My guess is that was a Ford Galaxy. George Bernard Shaw once said that the English and the Americans were two great people separated by a common language. It is my contention that today that the Republican and Democratic parties are two great parties separated by a common misunderstanding. Misunderstanding is cosmic in scope and galactic in proportion. Turns out that life on this planet may be like a bad B-rated movie when the main character turns to the other characters and says, you know, nobody's going to get out of this alive. And although the actor, well known enough to be a lead in a B science fiction movie, may have been referring to their reputations and resumes as actors, as well as their pretend life in that movie, it turns out that prophecies sometimes come from unusual places. When I was married to my second wife, we were separated for a while, and I moved into my mother's summer house in Key Largo. Yes, I had it tough. I was having a good time fishing for rainbow sea trout in Florida Bay, which the waters on the west side of the Keys are known. And I was doing my damnedest to play the part of the Hemingway-like character who drank too much, caroused with strange women, and wrote brilliant prose. Well, at least I was getting the drinking done. One night in the Keys, I dreamed that my 5-year-old daughter, Isabel, was taking a ride on my shoulders. And when I woke up from that dream, I could still feel her legs here. I got up, poured out the booze, threw the live shrimp into the bay. I was fishing with live shrimp and was getting a strike on every cast. Anyway, I freed the live shrimp, counted my money, and called a cab. When I got to the Greyhound bus station, it turned out I only had enough money to get to Orlando, Florida, which, if you're familiar with the geography of Florida, is nowhere within walking distance of the capital, Tallahassee. So on the bus ride from Key Largo to Miami, I had to do some fast thinking. Where was I going to get $40 to push my bus ticket all the way to Tallahassee? Bus stations, as you know, are always in dubious parts of town. And in Miami, it's no exception. I could see the Cuban pawn shops and jewelry stores up and down one street as we made our way to the station, and I thought, that's where I'm going to get the extra $40. The only thing I had of value at the time on me was a little bit of gold. First few jewelers and pawn shops I went into told me the same thing. It's a poor grade of gold, and it certainly wasn't worth $40. Then I happened on a jewelry store that was managed by a beautiful Cuban woman. I had something else that was of value, nearly always saleable, and that was a modicum of charm. So I turned the volume on that charm up to 10, and I went on in there, and she wasn't interested. That's when I told her why I wanted to sell my wedding ring. I had to get back to Tallahassee to reunite with my beloved wife and child. I may have been on the verge of tears. I may have even told her about the dream of my daughter, Isabel. I can't remember. The next step was obviously getting down on my knees. I didn't have to do that. The gold wedding ring went to the beautiful Cuban woman, but the $40 wasn't for the gold in the ring. It was in exchange for a story of romance gone awry. I rolled into Tallahassee about 4:30 a.m. that morning. Bus station is about 2 miles from Lake Ella, where my wife, Deborah, and my daughter, Isabel, were living with her. My wife's mother and father, Lino and Teresa Hernandez. I got to the lake when it was just beginning to show some light in the east, so I decided to walk around the lake till the sun came up. I was standing there with the lake between me and the rising sun, and all of a sudden I knew. No, it really wasn't knowledge. It was more something I felt. I felt that the sun was stationary and that it was the earth that was tipping eastward. My problems on this spinning orb were laughable at that point compared to the enormity of space and the light that was streaming at me from the sun, its mean distance from the earth described as one astronomical unit. Boy, you can say that again. I understood finally that the burdens I carried were fictitious, and I could, if I chose, discard them. At that moment, I walked to the house and rang the doorbell. My father-in-law, Lino, came to the door, all bleary-eyed, half asleep, and I asked him, "Can Deborah and Isabel come out and play?" Someone once asked Buckminster Fuller if he could imagine what it was like to be an astronaut. He laughed and said, "We're all astronauts. We're all riding our mother, spaceship Earth." There's a sense in which this Earth is our spaceship. We have a controlled atmosphere, food supplies, amusements on board. The leaders of this world, and certainly the leaders of this country, have decided to ignore the fact that we're on the same spaceship, the same vehicle. Why would anyone tease on board a closed atmospheric vehicle with others on board the same vehicle that they might use nuclear weapons in order to get their way? Think about it. It'd be like riding up I-35 and the person that you're riding with decides not to stop at the check stop bakery and Shell station, and you tell them if they don't stop, you're going to pull the pin on a concussion grenade that you happen to have in your jacket pocket. There's a disconnect somewhere in that kind of thinking. Is anybody paying attention to the fact that the billions that we're spending and making on this war could have fed the entire Earth several times over? And a lot of science fiction movies made where Earth is threatened from forces outside our galaxy. It looks like we've been looking too far away. It seems something closer to home will eventually be our undoing. So how can we defuse this bomb of a world? Can we defuse it? Is it hopeless? Are we doomed? Will nobody get out of this alive? Will we destroy our Earth? Jehan Nayar, a lecturer at the School of Law at the University of Warwick in Great Britain, has this to say. It is often that we think that to change the world, it is necessary to change the way power is exercised in the world. So we go about the business of exposing and denouncing the many power configurations that dominate, yet. To say the word power is to describe relationship. To acknowledge power is to acknowledge our subservience to that relationship. There can exist no power if the subservient relationship is refused. Then power can only achieve its ambitions through its naked form, which is violence. Nayar continues, changing the world, therefore, is a misnomer, for in truth, it is relationships that must be changed. And the only relationships we can change are our own, and the constant in all those relationships are the I of all of us. And so to change our relationships, we must change that I in each of us. Transformations of structures will follow. This is perhaps the beginning of emancipation. This is perhaps the message of all the Mahatmas. So what do we need to do to change the world? Is it possible to even talk like this? Is there one thing that we could do away with and everything would change? My problems on this spinning orb are laughable compared to the enormity of space and the light that was streaming at me from the sun, its mean distance from the earth described as one astronomical unit. Boy, you can say that again. I understood finally that my burdens, the ones I were carrying, were fictitious, and I could, if I chose, discard them. Rachel Naomi Raymond tells the story of a woman who was a cancer survivor. She lived in San Rafael, north of San Francisco. Helene was a truly gorgeous woman who took hours on her appearance every morning. She told Dr. Raymond that she was living with a man who was perfect for her, except for one exception. He lacked passion. He asked her permission every time he kissed her. She wasn't sure she wanted a man like that. All this changed on October the 17th, 1989, at precisely 5:04 p.m. On that afternoon, Helene was in one of downtown San Francisco's finest department stores. seeking the perfect outfit for a business dinner honoring her fiancé. In the company of a personal shopper, she was in a dressing room wearing a fuchsia silk dress that she had decided was just right. Both women were admiring the dress when the shopper suggested she wear it up to the seventh floor and match it with a pair of shoes. Leaving all her belongings in the locked dressing room, she went to the shoe department. She'd put on the perfect pair of heels and the perfect shade when the earthquake struck. All the lights went out. The building shook violently. She was thrown to the floor. In the darkness, she could hear things falling all around her. And when the shaking stopped, a few salespeople, several of the customers, and herself somehow made it down the darkened stairway to the front door. There was broken glass everywhere. Helene found herself standing in the street in a very expensive dress and perfectly matching 4-inch heels. Frightened and dazed, people rushed by her, all her clothes, her purse. Somewhere in the darkness of that chaotic building, probably not safe to re-enter, her money was in that purse and so were her keys. Walking to the corner, she picked up a telephone and it was dead. Helene was a person who could never ask for help, and this was no exception. She turned north and started walking toward San Rafael. It took her almost 8 hours to reach there. After a short time, her feet ached, and she threw away those fuchsia shoes. Her nylons tore, her feet began to bleed. She passed buildings that had collapsed, stumbled over rubble, waded through streets filled with filthy water from the firefighting efforts. Dirty, sweaty, and disheveled, she walked down the marina to the Golden Gate Bridge and crossed into the next county, Marin. She reached home somewhere after midnight and knocked on her own front door. It was opened by her fiancé, who had never seen her before with her hair down. Without a word, he took her in his arms, kicked the door closed, covered her dirty, tear-stained face with kisses, and made love to her right there on the floor. Helene is a very intelligent woman, but she could not understand why she had never met this ardent lover before. When she asked him, he simply said, "I was always afraid of smearing your lipstick." She tells me now that when she begins to relapse into her former perfectionism, she remembers the look of love in her fiancé's eyes when he opened that door. She had been looked at by men all her life, but had never seen that expression in a man's eyes before. My opinion is that in our efforts to remain aloof and perfect, in our desires to be in control and in the know, perhaps we have given those around us, those that are supposedly involved in relationships with us, the wrong message. There have been a lot of science fiction movies made, where Earth is threatened from forces outside our galaxy. Looks like we've been looking too far away. It seems something closer to home will eventually be our undoing. So this is what it boils down to. We can't change things by complaining about them. Power structures are based on relationship, and the only way power stays in power is for us to maintain a subservient relationship to their power structures. If we decide to build grassroots relationships closer to our homes and churches and ignore the call of big government, we can go so far as to refuse to pay taxes to support an unjust and profit-driven war. However, if we refuse this subservient relationship, we run the risk of being the object of ambitious power through its naked form, that is, through violence, and you will spend the rest of the war in jail. And yet, we must envision a new story for our species. We can no longer be satisfied with their country versus our country, nor especially our country, right or wrong. These attitudes are juvenile and lead from all-out competition to warlike stances and warlike actions now participated in by our government. We cannot rely on the fact that we're the only superpower on the block. Can't anybody remember what happens to the bully on the block when all the kids get tired of being beat up? A new story has to be written. Chief Seattle spoke these words not long ago, and they still ring true today. "I've seen 1,000 rotting buffaloes on the prairie left by the white man who shot them from a passing train. I am a savage. and do not understand how the smoking iron horse can be made more important than the buffalo that we kill only to stay alive. What is man without the beasts? If all the beasts were gone, man would die from a great loneliness of spirit. For whatever happens to the beast soon happens to man. All things are connected. This we know. The earth does not belong to man. Man belongs to the earth. This we know. All things are connected, like the blood which unites one family. I'm sure most of you have heard these words before, but what I want to know is who in this congregation knows the secret behind these words? This isn't a rhetorical question, or I'd be standing up there. Anybody know the secret behind these words? They were not written by Chief Seattle. The words I just read about the buffalo rotting the train, they weren't written by Chief Seattle. They weren't even spoken by Chief Seattle. They were written by a screenwriter in the 1970s by the name of Ted Perry for a movie called Home. And they were produced and distributed. That movie was produced and distributed in this country by, are you ready? The Southern Baptist Convention. Now, is this an outrage? I think not. You remember my story about getting back to Tallahassee from Key Largo? Do you remember these words? The gold wedding ring went to the beautiful Cuban woman, but the $40 wasn't for the gold in the ring. It was an exchange for a story of romance gone awry. The truth is, Chief Seattle did make a speech. It was similar to this. It just wasn't as good. So it was rewritten by a screenwriter. The gold, the truth in my wedding band wasn't worth $40. But the sad story of romance gone awry, now there was a universal truth that every woman could identify with. Jerry Manders, in his book, In Absence of the Sacred, says this about the works of Carlos Castaneda. He led millions through experiences designed to reveal unknown dimensions of our nature. And he did this all by imitating Native American storytelling style. Like the stories, myths, and histories Castaneda emulated, it scarcely mattered to what extent the characters were real or not. They were teaching systems. Our old stories of manifest destiny and dominion over this earth, granted to us by a single God in charge of everything, those stories were teaching systems too. They taught us that we lived in a mechanistic world and that cultures that believed that the earth was a mother and the sky was a father, those cultures were less advanced than us. We practiced what is nominally called cultural Darwinism. And in the process, we murdered millions of indigents, raped the land, made and broke treaties. Those treaties were teaching systems for the Indians. They taught them the white man could not be trusted. So the stories we hold on to, that we are better, that they are less developed, that we will win because we have the technology, all these stories are no more or less true than, say, the narrative of Jesus the Christ. We have suffered long enough from the stories that teach us not to respect the earth, the sky, and the beasts of the field. We must rewrite our cultural narratives. We must. Yet it seems that everyone is on board with this technological BS. And how can the most powerful nation in the world be wrong? But this is probably similar to the thoughts that run through the minds of lemmings as they follow the running procession off the cliffs and into the sea. I'm declaring today, the 2nd of July, 2006, Interdependence Day, and you're in just the right spot to celebrate. Today we celebrate that we have found a place where we can gather as free people, free community. We have found friends with whom we can share our hopes, our lives, our dreams. We have covenanted with one another to be there for one another, to love as unconditionally as we possibly can, to listen to one another, to grow in the fact that we can all believe whatever it is we believe simply because we believe it. No one here has been asked to leave their brain, their heart, or their social conscience at the door. We gather here as human beings possessed not only of the powers of ratiocination, but the willingness to imagine, there are other ways in which the world can be seen. We gather here for no other reason than to bask in the warmth of friendship, the beauty of fellowship, and the light of open-mindedness. The secret to the mundane drama of life is to hold your position while allowing others to hold theirs. The hope of the planet is in covenant communities like this. Our duty is to keep relationships alive at the grassroots level. If peace is to be practiced, it will be practiced here first. We teach love, grace, empathy, compassion, willingness to fail, the ability to be playful. We are free people, free men, women, and children who have agreed, we shall be as one from time to time. We shall recognize our interdependence. We shall humbly remember our births. We shall give credit where credit is due and live as lightly on this earth as we can. We are the hope of humankind. Changing the world, therefore, is a misnomer, for in truth, it is relationships that are to be changed. And don't tell me you don't know about changing the story, rewriting the plot. I don't believe that. There's hardly a one of you sitting here that was handed this particular covenant. Many of you are here not by default. No, we're here because we didn't like the stories we were born with. We weren't going to live our lives in guilt. We refused to accept the notion that God would condemn some to hell and others to heaven. We weren't satisfied with the scripts we'd been given. So what did we do? We rewrote the scenario to fit what matched our hearts and our minds. Our problems on the spinning orb are laughable compared to the enormity of space. And the light that is streaming to us from the sun, its mean distance from the earth defined as one astronomical unit. Boy, you can say that again. We must understand finally that the burdens we carry are fictitious, and we could, if we chose, discard them.